welcome. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. Tonight we have another great show dealing with metaphysics and science and physics and, well, you name it, it's probably going to be in there, because tonight's show is going to be God's Plan for the Test of Life. Yep. I want you to know, you know, that God and I had a conversation, and he told me, no, I'm kidding, of course. Kidding, of course. Actually, this is a compilation of a number of different sources plus my own ideas of God's plan for the test of life. It doesn't mean that there aren't some things that are going to be incorrect about what I might say, as well as some things might get left out, of course. In a two-hour show, I would challenge anybody to cover this subject. But at any rate, I thought we would try to, because there's a lot of questions that I hear, strangely, these days, even on news shows, about whether God did this or someone else did that, or whether it's inside of us, extrinsic to us. I mean, it's strange. It's on the news these days, especially about a specific football player, his ability to throw a football. I guess they think that God's aim is either good or bad these days. But I think the important thing here is that this is a much wider question than that silliness that I just mentioned. It's really about a big, big question. And why would God's plan involve a test for life in the first place? And what would that test be about? And what is life, of course, which a lot of you know that answer as far as I'm concerned, and that is that life is the means in which God decided to grow itself. Now, for a lot of people, they think that's blasphemy. Because if there's a God, God is the ultimate everything, end all, was all, will be all. And therefore, how does something like that grow? And interestingly, at the beginning, actually before there was what we call our universe, God was faced with the same exact choice, in my opinion. And that choice was, gee, I can just sort of sit here and be everything, be the end-all of everything, or I can choose another course. Well, the God of our universe appears to have chosen the course of creating life by limiting itself in a number of ways. And included in that limitation of God is a test of life, but not just a single test for all of life, but rather a myriad, a vast myriad of tests for different kinds of life, and when you reach anything near human life, tests that include specifics for the individuality of life, and human life has the hallmark of individuality as a part of its life. There's very little individuality until you come to human life. There's some small amount in primates, but the levels are so small. And we count or classify, humans do, the amount of individuality based upon the development of self. So if something can say to itself it has a self and identify itself in relationship to other things that are not itself and be able to make all kinds of choices and decisions and creative life decisions about that, then we could say that development of self is taking place in that creature or thing. Most of life does not have a self below humans, but some more advanced animals are beginning to develop that, and pets are the highest self that can be usually developed in animal life, pets of human beings. All right, so that being the case, we have some kind of definition of life. We have some kind of definition of testing life, so to speak, but being more specific, the test for life is how contributes to the growth of other life. Okay, let me say that again. The test for life is in what way or ways that it contributes to the further growth of other life besides itself, or its kind of life, in the universe. And for humans, that test is on an individual level, meaning how much we help any other individual or group part of life to support and grow more life. And for things that are less than human, well, in those particular cases, then it becomes something more on the, we'll call it, collective side. Particularly as the life lowers itself in consciousness and self development, then these tests are, generally speaking, about how a group of life, sometimes a species or whatever, contributes rather than any individual member of life does. So let me start with the very simplest kinds of pre-life, things that are not, by our definition of life, even yet alive. And in order to be alive, they have to be able, something has to be able to create more of at least itself, if not contribute to the development of other life. And so the very test of pre-life is to become life itself, to be able to create more of itself, to procreate, we might say, and to create some form of life in the process of its chemistry, usually biological in nature. Eventually, I should say, biological in nature. So that would be something like, let me give you an example, a rock made out of a bunch of different minerals. And those minerals are not organic at the point when they are made. They may be made under very high pressure and heat, and they may be combined in numerous kinds of ways. Eventually, they may become dissolved, usually in different forms of water, water that's alkaline, more often water that's acid, and exposed to various kinds of atmospheres that usually are different from the present-day type of atmosphere. And in that process, usually with some unusual forms of heat, electrical induction, and many other factors, some of these minerals start becoming organized in ways which we call organically based compounds. Organically based compounds include carbon in our world, but they don't have to technically, but here it's carbon. And carbon is a structuring compound. It holds things together. And then it allows usually fairly swift changes to take place infrequently within its molecular structure. And some of the things that do this are elements like nitrogen. So ultimately, in the system of minerals, before a mineral can become alive, it is tested to see whether or not it can eventually become an organic compound, and whether or not this organic compound can eventually move energy in and out of itself, and then eventually whether that, in moving it in and out of itself, it can do so in a way which is systematic and repeatable. And then we start talking about things like RNA, which is an acid-based organic compound that allows consistency of the amount in ways that energy moves in and out of its molecule. And then eventually that becomes DNA in some circumstances. So when we look at how God's plan is for testing pre-life, It has to do a lot with a thing called basically chemistry and organic chemistry eventually. Now, most of the time on a newly formed planet, for a considerable period of time, maybe a half billion years or longer, these organic compounds don't even form to the point where they can efficiently move energy, other forms of chemicals in and out of them. There's some basis that is consistent. Now, for some people, they would prefer to believe that this is a mechanical model, not based on God at all. But you see, it really isn't, because when you do the math, I'm just talking about, like, let's do the math, like, how long would it take with trillions and trillions and trillions of molecules, so to end up with a supportable form of even RNA coming out of the system. And that's like what a virus might be made. Certain types of viruses have only RNA in them. Well, the point here is that it would take somewhere around, if you put in all of the factors, about 2.5 or 3 billion years for this to take place. But we know as a fact it took place in about 0.5 billion years here in this world on Earth. And Earth was not particularly the most hospitable place for it to take place. But it seems to have done so. And then there's some evidence that it took place in less time than that on Mars as well. Although that's iffy because we don't have enough data to go there yet to trace this down. We will in a few years. But at any rate, the evidence on Earth is pretty clear. Now you might say, well, who came up with that? A guy named Francis Crick. Who is he? He's the guy who won the Nobel Prize, him and another fellow, for discovering DNA. Now, he had some help. He had an assistant, a lady, who probably should be given more credit. He and another fellow helped him. But the point was that he was one of the guys who came up with this model of DNA, but also figured out mathematically the time it would take to do this, and it just didn't work out very well. And so he had some problems, because originally he thought that the DNA principle could be a mechanical model and maybe didn't need the God in the picture. But as a scientist, he decided to do a lot of statistical calculations, which must have taken him a very long time. And then these were carried out by very famous institutions like Harvard, Yale, and so they did some of the same mathematical models that he did with using computers that were more advanced than when he was around, for sure. There were virtually none when he was around doing these experiments. And nothing comparable by today's standards, anyway. And so they came up with virtually the same numbers, something like 5 to 10 times the amount of time would be required to have life evolve, even starting with the very beginning, and then consistently throughout the models of changing life, like when we had suddenly life develop into bimodal forms of life, which had a front end and a back end and two sides that were mirrors of each other. All this stuff to have happen in the time it took was happening like at a pace 5 to 10 times normal. Well, the reason for that is because it's God's plan, and behind all of this mechanical stuff that's taking place, there's thought, which we call spirit, which carries out a lot of God's plan, even at the level of the physical world. Spirit goes all the way down to our level. And the spirit, which is controlled by an intermediary being called the monad, it's not important to know all that stuff. It's all part of God. It's really, this is God's means of doing this. And within God's means, God uses evolution as part of the test. But God also gives some weight, some very strong weight, to its own, we'll say, thought, which is spirit. And that spirit plays a big enough role to increase the factor by 5 to 10 times. That's a huge amount, by the way, at which life, by our standards, evolves and goes through these tests 5 to 10 times faster than would seemingly be in a calculatable form, take place. Wow. Well, that's a big deal. And the math and science that I'm telling you is not unknown. It is ignored, but it isn't unknown. So what does all this mean? Well, it means that God does have a plan, because it's God's own thought that is a major part of that plan. And the test of life is for life itself to find and develop, with a little help from its friend, God, or lot, depending on how you look at it, a means of first creating life itself from nothing, basically. It's self-created. And eventually create more of other kinds, create and support, I should say, more of other kinds of life. So lower forms of pre-life and life end up supporting much higher forms of life. It's a little easier to see when we go to the plant kingdom, because that's a real form of life. In between the plant and mineral kingdom, we find things that are not yet quite alive, things like viruses, as we talked about, but also sometimes molds and bacteria particularly. But bacteria also can be found between plants and animals. They are sub-kingdoms of life that on their own sometimes can't survive very easily. Bacteria can survive with no other life. And viruses can become inert and stick around for a long time, but they can't really grow without other types of life. So they're a little different. All right, so these types of life have a lot of purpose in them, but they have a connection to other life by usually supporting other life. Now, some of you are going to say, well, wait a second, what about viruses? Let's go back to that one. Viruses are unusual in that, for the most part, they are destructive to other kinds of life, but they are destructive in ways that causes the test for other kinds of life overcome them, and to achieve a higher, more developed nature. This is hard to understand, that there could be something that's really obnoxious and destructive, but yet isn't yet on the evil side. Evil is something that's doing it for the true destruction of life. We can say that most viruses are really, they are just to test life, because the weaknesses of life in terms of their narrowness and lacking the ability to adapt leads them into a negative outcome in terms of supporting other forms of life. Viruses correct that by challenging those forms of life that aren't being very effective in helping other life. So when human beings tend to get a lot of viruses, and we do, by the way, it's usually because we're quite selfish, and that has a lot to do with it. Something to think about. Okay, so God's plan for the test of life is to see if life in general can help other life grow more life, not to destroy life. Then we'll get to evil by the end of the show, but that's a special category and has to apply really to just humans. So if we look at plants and we say, well, what are plants here for? Well, plants do an amazing job of growing so many aspects of the environment to be supportive of life. They provide sources of energy to most other forms of life, either directly or indirectly. They also provide atmosphere. Sometimes, by the way, bacteria do too. And when they provide atmosphere, they convert the existing atmosphere, usually into an atmosphere that higher forms of life find more acceptable, usually because they can transfer the energy the plants are providing in and out of their systems more quickly in the new atmosphere. Let me give you an example. Plants take in carbon and oxygen. They split that carbon and oxygen together in the environment, which usually has hydrogen in it, and they make sugars and certain forms of proteins. When they do this, they expel out of their, metabolism, for the most part, oxygen. Oxygen provides a source of accelerated use of energy for most other animals, and allows the animals to feed on the plants and be able to use the plant energy more quickly than the plants can. So the animals can become animated, where the plants can't move or can't sense or move very quickly. The animals can. But the plants actually provide the vehicle for that with the oxygen and the energy that's inside them. If there wasn't oxygen, sufficient oxygen, the use of the energy in the plants would be useless to animals, because they would still be stuck at the same slow speed that plants use energy, which is just too slow to become animated and to have fast enough senses to use the animation in any reasonable fashion. You see how the symbiotic relationship here starts to become important. Now, why is it symbiotic back to plants? Well, this is a strange thing. When plants are eaten and used in other ways by animals, it tends to propagate them more, even though they're being consumed. Isn't that weird? Yeah, that's true. And so it helps them to grow, and it also causes them to be able to take more advantage of mutations within them, since they aren't animated and they can't grow or change or sense very quickly. By being spread around and moved around by more animated creatures such as animals, that includes insects, by the way, the results are that the plants propagate more quickly, mutate more often, and are able to accelerate their part of the plan. Wow. There's true symbiosis. But without plants, there could not be any more advanced life as we understand it, because of the lack of better senses and faster senses and animation. This is just amazing. Now, for a lot of people, they don't really think of insects as being part of animal life, but they are truly animated creatures, and they certainly are not plants. So the insects play a very important role here, because they are the beginning of the process of the animation issue. They first grew up in the oceans, and they didn't grow up in a sequential way to animals, other animals. They grew up first, but then very quickly, new kinds of animal life that weren't insect life came into being. Why? Because insects do not usually have a means of controlling the rate of oxygen that they consume. It's based almost entirely upon their environment. Whereas more advanced, we'll say, animals control the amount of oxygen they take in. We call it breathing. Usually because they have some form of lung and then circulatory system different from what the insects have. And so, consequently, it's a more advanced form of life, And it gives the animals that aren't insects the ability to truly take advantage of this ability to use oxygen. Now, when there were very, very high levels of oxygen in the atmosphere, insects did amazingly well because they actually have a number of advantages over other animals. And in their part of the plan, one of their advantages is they propagate amazingly quickly when there's high levels of oxygen, and they grow very large, actually larger than the animals around them. And so the results are that they are highly successful. And they were very successful during the carbonaceous and prior to that period of time when oxygen was like double, up to double what it is today in the atmosphere. But that form of oxygen, that much oxygen in the atmosphere, has some very negative effects. One of them is that if you even just rub two sticks together, you're liable to have a holocaust in fire. And certainly a lightning strike could be near like a bomb going off. So the problem is that once you get much over 20-25%, we're about 20-21 right now, on Earth with oxygen, the rate of energy exchange, not just between life and food or energy sources of it, but between everything, becomes so fast that the Earth becomes volatile. And the volatility makes it difficult for life to continue to grow. So, part of the plan was what? For the process of developing oxygen in high quantities to slow down. And the best way to slow it down is to have animals outside of just insects to start consuming more and more of the insects themselves and a lot more of the plants and become, we'll say, bigger eventually than the insects, but also to propagate in ways that are more successful than methods of insects use, and to grow in ways in which there's not an exoskeleton which slows down the rate of growth. And so all those things came together, amazingly, in God's plan. And if you think that this just happened by some willy-nilly mistake, just think of the odds of this really going on. I want you to think about this, how complicated this is. This is why a Nobel laureate said, hey, you can't do it that fast. You're skipping over all of the things that really make the definition of what we call life on Earth. It couldn't happen that quickly. And so, like, in tens of millions of years, literally, that's full time, by the way, all these things changed, and the oxygen levels began to quickly decline. That means the insects went from 3-foot wingspans down to 3-inch wingspans, or less, and their sizes diminished tremendously. Their numbers diminished equally to some extent, although because they were so small, there could still be a lot of them. They couldn't inhabit so many different niches because some of the niches they were inhabiting were taken over by more adaptable animals. They also couldn't live in such a wide variety of temperature variations in great numbers. So there are a lot of things that took place, and they lost their hold. This is about 300-plus million years ago. They lost their hold over life, and animals that were more adaptive and more senses, better developed, and the most important thing, could control the amount of oxygen going in and out of them at any particular time instead of being controlled by the oxygen surrounding them. Those animals became dominant. For the most part, they were reptiles. But towards the end of this epoch, there were a few mammal-like animals as well. Now, this is interesting, because as we look at God's plan for life, all of this is starting to make a lot of sense if we go back to our definition. The definition seems so simple. The insects couldn't really support more of life in the size that they were at and in the type of adaptations they were capable of doing. An exoskeleton, they were stuck within a very narrow range of temperature. There was also a lot of other issues in their environmental interactions that caused them to just not move very much ahead. One thing that was really true about insects is they just didn't have what we would call big brains. And their ability to think was limited in a strange way. They, in order to be able to develop big brains, you have to consume a lot of protein. And the amount of protein that insects could consume, because they weren't warm-blooded and because of other factors, was too limited to develop very big brains. Matter of fact, they virtually had no brains. Most insects have, like, something we might think of as like a little brain kind of thing, but not really. And so they were not, they didn't, never were able to develop the kind of knowledge that was necessary to make the kind of choices so they could be more supportive of life on a greater and greater level of some amount of individuality. Just as they were informed from their group soul, and they just worked basically on the instincts, and that's it. They all kind of did the same thing. Some of them did it together, like bees and ants, much later, by the way, in development of insects. And others just kind of were given a set of basic instincts and didn't fall very much from that pattern. Now, once you get enough animals, even other reptiles, that are controlling more of their life, even though they still may be cold-blooded, that's a very, you know, restrictive quality, so they have certain issues about the environment. But they still can control the amount of oxygen, and they can control, therefore, more about how much they ate, what they ate, when they ate. And this had a lot to do then, and where their environment would eventually be that they lived. And this had a lot more to do then with the development of a brain. And brain is a storage device for knowledge. Everybody thinks that the brain is everything about thought. The brain is a connective instrument involved in thought, but it is not the originating source of thought. But enough of that for tonight. At any rate, so the animals were really taking over because insects are so limited. Also, the animals, the reptiles, while they did have to shed some of their skin, and there were some leftover elements of that in terms of growth, it wasn't an exoskeleton, they still had bones, and they still had the ability to grow more rapidly than to be controlled by an exoskeleton. They had an inner skeleton, but they still sometimes shed skin. All right, so here in God's plan, we can now see that moving away from insects, in the plants are still, by the way, growing crazy because the insects helped to develop plants, and now the other animals are starting to develop plants. So you've got a really great system here that's quickly becoming supportive of life outside of its own specific life and is becoming a true ecological system. Some animals eat other animals and plants, maybe, if they're both. And if they only eat other animals, then they have a special niche and they develop the ability to hunt. And if they eat plants, they develop the ability to live a life that usually does not require as big a brain. But they also have another means of helping to support another life because they support, of course, the propagation of plants and support carnivores. So, you know, omnivores are obviously doing a little bit of both. So you got a little bit of everything going on here in this system of testing life. It's really a wonderful plan because it provides opportunity for the three parts of God's mind to finally start working together in a more balanced fashion. What do I mean by that? Well, we'll cover more of this when I come back for break. But God's plan is to use God's thought, which is spirit, to accelerate God's plan for evolution with the exchange of energy and the use of energy, which is the third part of God's mind. Because the third part of God's mind is about action, about activity. In order for something to be alive, it has to be more than just thinking. It has to be interacting. That's what gives everything that is in life the opportunity for its own self-created growth. So energy is a part of the system. Theoretically, you can do it without what we call energy, and there still be some form of interaction. But that's in realms that we don't even talk about usually on this show. For the most part, to us, energy is almost always involved in some interactions. And that's exactly what's going on when we think about God's plan for life. I hope this is making some sense. I know it's a little complicated, but I find it to be the kind of thing that allows us to maybe answer some really important questions later in the show about how much is God interacting with us and how much are we interacting with God. And what is controlling our behaviors or not, et cetera. This is an important element that I'm moving towards, but I'm trying to show how this plan of God develops to eventually our level and, of course, beyond. Okay, so what we're going to do right now, we'll take a break, and when we come back in about 2.5 minutes or so, we'll continue our talk about God and his plan, and then some of the more practical matters eventually about being human. And we'll be back in 2 minutes and 30 seconds from about right now.
Hi, everyone. Since childhood, I've had questions about my life and life in general that I couldn't find adequate answers to. Questions like, why am I here? Why are others here? Does the universe have a purpose? And how does that relate to my life? More recently, I've been wondering what happens when we die, especially the reasons why. I'm more of a doubter than a believer in many things, and answers that include the whys allow me to think and figure out the truth for myself. I've been reading a book, Life's Hidden Meaning. This one book contains more answers, including the whys, than all other sources I've read or heard. It's amazing to me that every one of my questions has been thoroughly answered. More importantly, I have found that all of these answers so far have checked out to be true. I hope this message helps some of you in your quest for better understanding. The name of this wonderful book is, again, Life's Hidden Meaning by metaphysician Niles McFlower. Some bookstores sell it. I got my copy directly from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com. Life's Hidden Meaning may enlighten your mind and bring some peace and joy to your heart.
Hun, what book are you reading?
It's a novel, kind of, about romance, love, and spiritual life in general.
Kind of a novel? What do you mean?
Well, it's based on some real-life experiences and even real characters. Some of their experiences are fascinating and remarkable. I can't put this book down.
How come the title is Afterlife Love?
That's part of the fascination. This book describes the afterlife in intricate detail and even explains why things are the way they're explained.
But how can anyone write about or know that?
Some of the characters travel out of body to some places that people who've already died also go to. I'm finding it completely believable because it all makes sense and fits into a bigger picture for me.
Hun, what happens to these people?
You can read it for yourself when I'm done if you want.
Better yet, I'll get my own copy so we can discuss it while we read. Let me see. I'll write down the title. It's Afterlife Love by Niles McFlower. McFlower.
Afterlife Love is available in some bookstores and from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com or 480-966-3132. That's 480-966-3132.
we're back. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. Tonight we're talking about God's plan for the test of life. And we kind of stopped at the point where we had reptiles, although before reptiles, to be very frank, you know, there were other forms of life, of course. We have to look at fish, you know, and of course, that's a whole other aspect to it. But I'm trying to show, basically, how you move from one particular kind or form of life to another. Because in the oceans, as an example, as fish developed, the insects were developing in the oceans first, and they were in competition with each other. As there was more and more oxygen in the water in the oceans, say, 450 million years ago, the insects really had the upper hand, and they even got out into the land before the fish did, when they became amphibians. But interestingly, the insects only had the advantage as long as oxygen levels were at 30% or more in the atmosphere. And that went on for about 100 million years or so. Then they lost the advantage as soon as amphibians, by that point, and fish in the oceans as well, were able to ingest more and more oxygen by the development of their and complexity of their bodies and the development of brains. This allowed them to then operate independent of how much oxygen was just running around the room. And they can convert energy much more efficiently in accord with what they were doing in their daily life activities. And activity is a big issue because it's the third part of God's mind. As a creature becomes more and more self-regulated in its activity, its test of life becomes closer to succeeding in being able to propagate first more of its own species and then becoming part of the overall scheme of developing life in all else. This is the fun part. And if I were God, and we all are a part of God, that to me would be the interesting thing, is to see life on its own, self-created, finding ways to help all life to grow as it grows itself at the same time. Very fascinating kind of development. So I didn't want to leave that part out, although I'm trying to go fairly quickly over this older stuff that happened, but so that all of you have a foundation to realize that fish and amphibians eventually became far more advanced than the insects, which used to feed on them, and were the actually superior forms of life, like 500 million to 400 million years ago in the oceans, and then eventually on land from 400 million years ago to maybe 320, 330 million years ago. So when we look at this, we can see that, wow, that's a pretty amazing thing, that that insects really had the upper hand until oxygen levels fell. Once they fell, then it was really the forms of life that controlled the rate of oxygen that had the big advantage. There was a contest about 350 million years ago or so between insects and other forms of, we'll call it animal life, in which there was almost a balance because there was a lot of oxygen, but the other forms of animal life were getting better and better at being more adaptable and controlling the rate of energy that they used so that they could become more vicious carnivores or more propagating herbivores in their means of making a living. Insects were kind of stuck with just one thing and one thing only, and that was based upon how much oxygen seeped into them through the outside environment. All right. Now, there are a few insects, by the way, that developed a kind of very rudimentary form of we'll call it semi-lung situation. It's just that it was so inefficient compared to animals then it never could catch up with the way animals were. All right, so getting back to our whole story now, it's kind of interesting. Eventually, we reached the point where these very early mammals that existed from about 300 million years ago to about 250 couldn't get very large. Now, you would think that they would have an advantage because they had generally nice-sized brains for their size, physical size. And they also had a number of other things going for them in that day. Gave birth to their young and took care of them, and they weren't prone to the propagation, wasn't prone to being eaten as eggs, etc. And so they didn't use up a lot of their energy, you know, taking care of a nest of eggs that something else came along and ate, or something came and destroyed. That's a good thing, and it is it was a betterment in terms of that process. The problem that the mammals had at that time was that the reptiles, which were the dominant form of animal life on the physical part of Earth, and in the waters as well, by the way, along with the fish, didn't allow, because of their, we'll say, success in their development, didn't allow for the increased adaptability of mammals to become more dominant in terms of life. So mammals were really on the fringe of things and oftentimes on the dinner plate of reptiles. And then you could say, well, what about those dinosaurs? Well, dinosaurs didn't come around until after the Permian period when there was a huge die-off of most of the reptiles. And then you could say, well, why didn't the mammals just pop in? Well, because the dinosaurs actually adapted between the two species. Most people don't know this, but dinosaurs were not reptiles, really. They were kind of a mix between mammals and reptiles. They were probably, most of them were probably warm-blooded, not as hot-blooded as a full mammal. And they had almost like two hearts. Their pumping system was helped by their liver, it appears, in some of them, especially the carnivores. And they also could adapt amazingly well, and some of them were smart as some mammals, and they had a lot of other amazing adaptations in development. They seemed to use energy as efficient as most mammals even do today. Now you could say, well, why didn't they take over the Earth and all this stuff? And that has to do with God's plan. In God's plan, God focuses on the development of certain attributes. And during the period of the dinosaurs, which is called the third ray type of energy development, the most important thing was interaction mode. So we could say that dinosaurs were focused on developing to the highest level possible the most efficient forms of interaction, which they managed to do. Whereas mammals were more about consciousness. But that was not going to develop to its highest level until the next round or development of God's focus here on Earth. Mammals came about earlier than dinosaurs because during the second round development, consciousness was a focus. The problem is that mammals were so rare and so few and far between, and whatever there were, few of them, they never got a leg up on the existing amphibians and reptiles. So it was kind of interesting that in the beginning of the development of consciousness, because reptiles and amphibians and fish were so much more developed from prior life development, in the beginning of the development of consciousness, that a much more developed in consciousness mammal couldn't catch up, because its form of development of consciousness was so much more advanced that it needed a different world in which to exist than the world that existed for the fish, the amphibians, and the reptiles. And I guess we could include the insects during part of that time. What was off, you can say? Well, a number of things. The climate wasn't right. The adaptability of mammals is usually focused around the need to propagate through internal development. Even if they're marsupial, more part of the time, they're in the mother's little sac and outside of a physical body, it still requires an environment that is kind of hospitable for that. Eggs can be more easily dealt with by being buried, keep them warm, or cooled, if that's necessary, by exposing them. There's so much more you can do with an egg, and that's part of the problem mammals are facing. And this is all part of God's plan, though. Mammals were not ready to take over the world at the time that we had fish, and amphibians, and then reptiles. And there needed to be an in-between niche that would develop a much larger brain, that would develop some of the qualities that mammals have, more than you might believe, and that would also become somewhat or semi-warm-blooded for most of their species, and those were dinosaurs. I know you read 15, 20, 50 years ago, whenever you read it, the dinosaurs were cold-blooded. That was a mistake. It was just a mistake. Scientists believe that that was true because they thought they were much closer to reptiles, but dinosaurs are their own thing. To call them a reptile would be inappropriate today. You just have to call them a dinosaur. That's basically it. Were there some that were cold-blooded? Probably. A lot of species we didn't even know found yet. But it looks like the majority, especially if you're talking about the carnivores, the theodonts, the ones that were more aggressive, they almost certainly were warm-blooded, but usually cooler than us, like 80, 90, up to 90 degrees Fahrenheit. Certainly nowhere near where most mammals are today. But that's very warm, by the way, meaning that they had to control the amount of oxygen and food to a much higher level than a cold-blooded reptile does, because it uses some of the energy of its surroundings to keep itself warm, and sometimes to even hibernate when it's too cold. So this is an important thing, an important lesson for us, actually. God's plan is to bring in new forms of life early, but they don't really take over the environment. They have to learn and be tested by the plant. Many of them don't survive, but they help to develop more and more developed of their kind of life. That's what happened with mammals. You could say mammals existed 270 million years ago, but they didn't become dominant, truly, until 50 million years ago. Now, why not? The environment wasn't right for them. And there were some very big dinosaurs to compete with, and they were pretty darn small little creatures, and all they were hors d'oeuvres for a lot of these dinosaurs. And even before the dinosaurs, there were some pretty big reptiles in there. So it was a fairly inhospitable place for a little tiny mammal to grow. Right. So the test here was that you had to have an intermediary source. And eventually, even the gene pools probably became somewhat intermingled. I know it's hard to believe this, but there seems to be some crossover animals that were somewhat dinosaur and somewhat mammal. That's even hard to decide for sure what is what, you know. And this was true even as early as 200 million years ago and as late as 70. So there was a lot of experimentations going on. because life is continually being tested to see if it will help to develop more and greater amounts of life. So whatever happened to the dinosaurs? Well, about 90 million years ago, they started to significantly decline in the numbers of species, etc. Until about 70 million years ago, there was very few kinds of dinosaurs in most locales. A bit more in South America, but very few in North America of any variety. So, and Africa and other places sort of in between. So there's very few new types of dinosaurs. They're just getting bigger and nastier. And mammals actually were starting to become a little more varied, although they were very small. I mean, you'd be hard-pressed to find a mammal much more than 20, 25 pounds. But the mammals had one thing going for them. They could live underground, which they usually had to because the dinosaurs were pretty formidable. And they also were very good about being able to propagate under the most hostile circumstances. And they didn't rely on eggs. And so this was always a good thing when things got really tough. And they got tough. The environment for 70 million years to about 65 million years ago became pretty toxified with a lot of volcanoes and other kinds of things like that. And then you've all heard about the big rock that came from the sky, or it may have been a comet as well, but whatever it was, it tended to create such a hostile world because of the explosion and the raining down of fire and eventually the destruction of most of the habitat, that unless you were very small and were living underground and could stay there for a protracted period of time and propagate underground, you probably weren't going to survive. I mean, that's what happened to all the big creatures. Anything like over about 25 or 30 pounds just died out, which is most of the dinosaurs. And the rest of them kind of became birds, strange as it may seem, of one sort or another. And the mammals that existed were now able to eventually live above ground, taking over the habitat the dinosaurs were living in, and be able to more effectively use the environment because they had an even higher metabolism. Their temperature went up from the 80s, maybe 90 degrees in terms of body temperature, to 100 on an average. Well, that's a big jump. When you have that kind of temperature, and by the way, of course, reptiles continue to exist in their own niches to some extent. Funny that the dinosaurs didn't, because they were cold-blooded. And so, amazingly, they were more adaptable in an environment that got very cold after several months of firestorms, etc., became very cold after the big, whatever, wallop. And they were able to survive where the dinosaurs weren't. They were cold-blooded. Their body temperatures were whatever was outside. Well, outside, it sometimes got down below zero because it was cloud-covered with all the smoke and clouds and everything else. And so, because we had, like, some people call it nuclear winter kind of approach, for years, some of them froze, literally, and may have survived for several years in a frozen state. And you might say, well, that's not possible. No, it is possible. It's possible. It's been proven to be possible. It's amazing, but cold-blooded creatures can actually do this sort of thing. And so they would just freeze over and go into a stupor. And when they would come out of it, sure enough, there they were again. Same is true of some of the smaller, very small amphibians like frogs. And so at least one species or more of them were able to survive. But they couldn't any longer take over the Earth because now there were two things, birds and mammals, which were in competition with each other. Dinosaurs were gone. And they were running at higher temperatures. Higher temperatures means faster exchange of energy. Faster, usually, development of brain growth. And the ability to accumulate more complex forms of food, including certain amino acids, to develop a bigger, faster brain. So the whole thing swings towards the advantage of birds and animals. That's where it all comes from. And remember, the birds do appear to have come from the dinosaurs. So the dinosaurs that were small enough seem to have become what we today would call birds, and it survived all the disasters that took place about 65 million years ago. Now, God's plan. How is this all going in God's plan? Well, life is being tested. Life is being tested in numerous ways to see if it can adapt in ways in which it not only supports the propagation of its own species, but helps the development of all other life. Dinosaurs were not doing that. As dinosaurs did not help the development of all other life, the number of kinds of species of dinosaurs dropped radically 70 million years ago. And this is not just a question of volcanoes or an asteroid. This is the question of spirits and controlling animal life. There's all kinds of gaps that shouldn't have happened as quickly as they do. And those gaps are caused by the plan of God. Also, the third type of energy was going out 65 million years ago. It had been in existence for a long time, like 160, 180 million years, ever since the end of the Permian period, really, which is 250 million years ago. And certainly by 225, the third ray was in big time. And continued until 65 million years ago. That's a long, long time. And what does a third ray do? It makes animals a lot more active. It does develop more intelligent animals. That's a good thing. A third ray. And it creates animals that are much more interactive. The same happened to plants, by the way. The plants became much more interactive because you ended up with flowers. Flowers were being developed towards the end of the dinosaurs. And the flowering plants are much better propagating, and they're much more interactive. They work with social insects like bees, etc. And there's a whole other ecology going on in this process. So the plant is really moving towards interaction all during the third ray development. But the fourth ray became the dominant ray when mammals came. Now, what's the hallmark of the fourth ray? The hallmark of the fourth ray is a greater balance between the thought of God and evolution. So there's an improvement between the one-sided nature. The third ray tends to, we'll say, have less spirit involved in it. So you would say the dinosaurs were not what you would call the most spiritual of animals. And the fourth ray tends to, when it's in focus, tends to start developing mammals a lot more, with the eventual outcome being human beings. But spirit becomes the dominant feature. But also, spirit dominates during the first half to three quarters of the fourth ray cycle. And then when human beings come in, human beings are supposed to bring about the eventual balance between the two. Did you follow that? I hope you did. So we're supposed to balance between the interaction of kingdoms towards evolutionary survival of the fittest, destruction, etc., which is a lot of the way we lived in our earlier development as humans, to spirits becoming a balance to that, not necessarily ruling the situation, but balancing it so that you still have evolution taking place. But now you have evolution in which the animals themselves, us, are taking charge over the system and making critical decisions about adaptation, life development, propagation, and exchange of energy. we are finding that when we exchange energy too quickly, without there being a spiritual base, we choke off the planet, create global warming, imbalance our economies, and create general destruction of our species, both plants and animals. And we're trying to figure out how we can balance this in ourselves with a process in which we take concern of stewardship of all the other parts of life while we still expand our civilization, which incorporates these other parts of life, of extension of our lives. And at the present time, we are in a test about it. That test will be, at some point, a pretty serious test. I think this year is the beginning of the seriousness of that test. Now, not because I'm a Mayan person, but because the Mayans were told about this by others who weren't Mayans. They were people who came here who told them. Yeah. But at any rate, that's a whole other show, right? And so here is the point. We are facing issues today as part of our testament plan that was foretold ages ago. I mean, the whole thing has been kind of like designed to produce these effects. Human beings shouldn't even exist yet. But we were accelerated in our existence in order to make everything move faster. Partly because one of our tests is about evil and overcoming it, which I'll talk more about in a little bit. But it's nonetheless part of the whole plan. And it's going to be a big test for human beings. Yeah, it's always been a big test, but it's going to be even bigger. All right, so let me just give a little break. I covered a huge amount of territory, and there's a lot to talk about. So, again, this could be a 12-hour show. It could be 24 hours. I don't know how many hours you could talk about this because there's so much I'm not including. But it's, a, you know, it's all food for thought and gives you something to think about. Let me make some mentions. If you happen to be into the Phoenix metropolitan area, in especially more towards the east side, in the near future, on January 16th, which is this coming Monday, from 7 to 8:30, one of the people I'm friends with and know well, and is a member of the spiritual group I'm part of, is going to be giving a talk on Atlantis. So if you're interested in anything dealing with Atlantis, you can go hear Mimi talk about it, and you can interact with her about it. It's open to the public. There's no charge, and it's at Barnes & Noble at Tempe Marketplace. That's McClintock and Loop 202. McClintock and Loop 202. Pretty easy to get to because it's by the freeway. I try to get there around 7 o'clock, and we'll go from 7 to 8:30. No charge. That's right. It's the southeast corner of the store. That's how you can find her. You'll find, you know, if you can't find her, you can always have someone who will point you in the right direction. So if you want to go hear her talk, please do. She'll be doing that. Okay. Also want to mention, if you haven't tried it, to try 5-GGZIC. I know a lot of people these days are having bouts of the flu, et cetera. GGZIC does help lowering fevers. You may still want to take some aspirin or Tylenol with it if you have that, because it only can lower a fever maybe a couple degrees, two or three. And if you have 3 or 4 degrees of fever, you want to take something else with it. And in addition, it gets rid of most of the body aches, which is really great because you know how those can be in this day. So if you haven't gotten some GGZIC, do get some. Go to buygzik.com over on the internet and check it out. Also, you can call 602-431-5762 and ask about getting some GGZIC that way. GGZIC works on the principle of Eastern and Western science. It works on the concept of chi and how chi is the energy of life. check it out. Also, if you feel the flu coming out, Soul Balance, get some Soul Balance. Take about 9 of those every 4 hours for the first day or two, and you will feel a lot, lot better, especially if you take the G-Sick with it. Oh, it's a lot of pills, I know, but it's a lot worse to be sick. And then you can start decreasing the amount of the both the G-Sick and the Soul Balance, so that after a few more days, you might be taking half of what I just suggested. But the point is that you will feel a lot better, and it may shorten the term, the time you have the flu, by just a few days instead of a few weeks. Very important thing to consider. Okay, just those things to bring to your mind. I hope that gives you some idea of, you know, some stuff that we sometimes offer you as options. Right now, a lot of people are getting an A-type flu that hangs on for a long time, can turn into bronchial or, you know, bronchitis or pneumonia or both. Those are bad secondary infections. And in those cases, you may have to take an antibiotic to even deal with them. Yeah, besides the Soul Balance. Soul Balance is mostly for, most of its effect is on viruses. It has supportive value for bacterial infections. But if you have pneumonia, you're going to need, you know, one of the penicillinase types of drugs or something like that. You need to go see someone to get that. You can't just go, unless you live outside the United States, you can't just go to your drugstore and say, well, I want this, I want that. Because they won't do it without an Rx. No. Okay, so think about that. And now is the time to have some around. And believe me, this year it would be good to have a few bottles of each of these at all times. We just don't know what's coming. But I think what is coming is going to balance, so to speak, what's been happening in the past, and it may not be that great. And it has a lot to do with tonight's show and the test of life. Okay, so humans come in because the read change, the focus, is on 4 rays at a time instead of 3, with the 4th ray being the most critical ray that's focused on the most, and the 3rd ray being lessened to some extent in its focus. But the most important thing is you go from 3 rays to 4 rays at a time. This accelerates the growth of life tremendously. So when you accelerate the growth of life, with some of it being now more towards the spiritual side, at least balanced in that direction, you end up with mammals really just taking off and growing to much larger sizes, and the same with birds. And now you've got a real difference in the way that life is. You get birds as tall as 10 feet or higher running around that look like more like dinosaurs than birds. Remember, they came out of them. And then you've got mammals starting off being 20 or 30 pounds, but eventually growing to the size of hundreds of pounds of size. Some mammals eventually become 2, 3, 4 times larger than an elephant. Wow. Some carnivores become the same number of times larger than a lion. Yeah, it's pretty big. Carnivores, not as big as a dinosaur. Why not? Because the 3rd ray tends to grow things a lot bigger in general. The 4th ray balances itself out better. And size is not the main issue. Quality and intelligence becomes a lot more important in something that's growing both under the 4th ray and at the same time under 4 rays at a time, in comparison to 3 rays at a time with the dominance of the 3rd ray. So we have a totally different kind of effect, a different kind of thought coming from God's mind. God says, well, now it's time to go this direction. And evolution takes a big, hard turn to the right, and things change much faster than they should. Now, why do I say that? Well, you know, if you use Crit's plan or idea, from just 10, well, even 5, but in 10 million years, from the almost complete obliteration of most life on the planet. 90% of all the species gone, or 70%, yeah, 90% of all the species gone. A huge amount of life gone. The results are the following. You end up with there being more variety of life and faster amounts of growing life in both the seas and on land by 50 million years ago than you had 70 million years ago. Now, what sense does that make? Not much. All right. And then, in addition, we find the planet changing in its structure. The consistency of climate is moving very rapidly from one place to another. Seas are changing rapidly from one wave to another. And so you're getting something where if the life isn't more adaptable and more intelligent, it would die out. Now, the evolutions say, well, that's the reason life went that way is because the world changed and it just had to. Yeah, except you get the problem with this. If it really had pushed on the adaptation of life, then you would have lower numbers that are more adaptable, but lower numbers. Not these huge, vast numbers of life all over the place. So soon after, an apocalypse of destruction. Attitudes don't quite add up, and they don't add up because there's not enough time for them to add up to. Because the time difference is made up by God's thought or spirit. There's a spiritual understanding, a spiritual message behind all of the changes. And that's God's plan, testing life through some aspects of evolution, but behind that, a lot of spiritual development, coming from group souls, by the way, too. So it's a partnership of God in life and God's way of helping to grow life. And it ain't all evolution. As a matter of fact, evolution might be somewhere around 10 to 20% of the real development of life if you believe Crick's model of time. And I think that's a pretty good way of measuring it. If it would really take 5 to 10 times more time, then only 10 to 20% of the evolutionary model is correct, and the rest of it is based upon spirit, as I'm describing it, or some other factor. Okay, and that's just, if you're a statistician, you'll understand what I'm saying. All right, so what does this all mean? Well, eventually it's leading to the development of us, of humans. But here's the problem. If you really develop the plan of development, you know, of human beings, it would take at least an additional 10 million years from the time that we know or believe human beings had anything to do with anything, which means that we wouldn't even be here yet for human beings to develop by our standards, because we think human beings developed just a few million years ago. The truth is they were around much earlier. About 15, 16 million years ago, there was some form of kind of a human being, but pretty ape-like still. And the point is that that was still hugely faster than the development of human beings, because even by evolutionary models today, we shouldn't yet exist. It's way too fast. So how can we do it? Well, because part of what God's plan was to get human beings into action on Earth as quickly as possible. If this had been a normal planet without certain critical tests involved, we would be developing right now as individual souled beings, joining somewhat with certain advanced primates of various different kinds of group souls, and becoming human today, maybe, or maybe a million years from now. But it'd be that much later. But that wasn't part of God's plan for Earth, because we're here to deal with the problem of evil. Now, what's that problem? Well, evil doesn't exist until humans exist. And part of the plan for Earth is to find ways of overcoming a thing called mental development of evil. This is the reason evil doesn't exist before humans, is because without mental development, evil itself doesn't have the ability to become self-created. Animals, by not being developed enough mentally, cannot be the progenitor of evil. They can become evil by their spirit being tainted by human beings. But if there are no human beings, there would be no animals that are evil. Even the most ferocious of the dinosaurs were not evil. They were just ferocious big beings, big beasts. We are evil. And what is evil? Evil means that, as I said, in God's plan, the test for life is to, for one part of life to help other life to grow. But evil is the opposite of that. It's not part of God's plan, other than God chooses to allow freedom. And freedom, in terms of humans, is that humans can reject God's plan. And God's plan is to help life to grow other life. So if humans reject that and reverse it, which is what evil does, and humans are here to destroy life, that helps to create other life, and therefore to destroy life itself. And the reason for it is that humans, when they're evil, choose to destroy God and its plan. Now, what the heck is life doing with that idea? And it goes something like this. Evil works based upon power, and it seeks to control, and it sees God as a competitor to that system. God's got this thing called spirit on its side, and the spirit's always meddling in all the interactions that evil wants to do through power and control. And it doesn't like that. So it does several things. First of all, it tries to get others to think that God doesn't exist, and that it doesn't exist as evil. And at the same time, it tries to destroy God by destroying God's plan of helping life to help other life. It instead gets other life to destroy anything dealing with God, including the helping of other life. It isn't angry about life. It isn't even seeking some kind of retribution on God. It is indifferent to God and life. It only wants power and control. And it doesn't really care, in a sense, about God or its plan. It just wants to do away with it. So you can't really say that evil is angry as much as it is indifferent and seeks power and control at any cost. God recognizes this and has created certain plans for certain planets, Earth being one of them, where this contest is to be played out. And in order for that to take place on Earth, because of the needs for the resolution of the contest within literally hundreds of thousands of Earth years from right now, the process on Earth had to be accelerated by better than 10 million years. Now, there's some cost to be paid when you do this, because that means you have to throw most of the elements of evolution out the window, forget about any missing links, and you have to then find a way of inculcating spirit more quickly into the process in the etheric part of the physical world, so that you can end up with a human being 10 million years plus earlier than you would. Actually, it's closer to 20, but because they started more than 20 years earlier. And so that was the overall idea. And the reason for it is to try to come up with a successful planet Earth being one of the ones getting tested, that would fight off evil from becoming mental instead of just astral in its nature. As long as evil is astral in its nature, it cannot take over the universe. It cannot destroy God's plan. It can be a fly in the ointment, a mosquito bite, but it's not going to be anything super serious. However, if evil takes over the lower mental world, even just the fifth subworld of the lower mental world, God's plan is at risk. Now, you could say, but this is just Earth. What about the zillions of other planets throughout the universe where this isn't happening? But that's not the problem. The problem is that given enough time, and evil has time, it could eventually take over significant parts of the universe, and God's plan could fail. Now, could God's plan really fail? No. Because God stacked the cards a long time ago, figuring all this could happen. And it has ways of manipulating the system through spirit alone, so that although we may have a few Earths go completely sour and fail, there will still be remaining ones that will find successes about this issue of mental, lower mental evil developing to the point to overcome a planet. And those successes will eventually resolve ways in which it can be adopted to all planets, even a planet as bad off as Earth is, to guard humans from this great, terrible occurrence. But for us on Earth, it's still a touch-and-go problem, because we are not succeeding up to this point. And if we were to lose, the planet goes dark. And the planet goes dark and goes bye-bye. Why? Because just like any other experiment that might go wrong, you don't leave the remnants of it to contaminate everything else and destroy the universe. You just do away with the planet. I know it sounds terrible, and that God would interfere with life to such a level, but that's part of God's plan, and it's part of the test. All the souls that are human souls came here with this knowledge. They don't exist here in a vacuum. They know that should this planet in general fail in its test of keeping life going to help other life to grow, and if it does the reverse and becomes evil, they know that Earth will be destroyed. Now, I'm not a doomsday sayer. I don't want you to think I'm sitting here saying, it's the end of the world, it's the end of the world, you know, and they call me Little, you know, Chicken Little. But no, that's not what I'm trying to explain. I'm just saying that there is a fail-safe mechanism in place. There is a definite end to the succession of evil. I can even give you the percentages. When evil becomes greater than 25%, one out of four people don't believe in God, or believe in, we'll say, an anti-God of sorts. They believe, yeah, God goes out and kills everybody. That's what God does. When 25% of the humans on Earth are in that ballgame, it's curtains for Earth. How do I know that? Well, you remember, maybe it's going to be talking about Atlantis on Monday. That was already tried. Atlantis reached the 25% level. And what did God decide to do? Well, it wiped out Atlantis and almost everything we know about it, other than a few bits and pieces that are left. And hundreds of cities are underwater today that existed as a part of an Atlantean empire. Some of them were subjected to by Atlantis, others were free cities. But it doesn't really matter. They existed. And are gone, as almost everything about Atlantis was deliberately buried and obscured by more spiritually developed people to prevent us from knowing about it, because in order to find out all the good things about Atlantis, we would reconstruct all the bad things, and it would be like nothing was ever wiped out. Will we eventually find out about Atlantis? Yes, probably sooner than later, which may not be the best thing for us. But nonetheless, that was the ratio. It was about 1 out of 4 when all that terrible stuff happened. Same thing happens this time. There's no trying over again because there isn't enough time for the plan to progress and for human beings to develop a new form of civilization. There's just not enough time. So if we get to that level, it's gone. You can say, well, I know how many people are evil around me. It's not very much. I look out there and not too many. I understand what you're thinking. And to some extent, there's truth to that. But on a practical side, I want you to think about this. How many countries right now are run by some form of dictatorial government, which is obviously evil? We thought we got rid of it in the old Soviet Union, right? Well, it's coming back in March. It's been festering in there pretty much for the last 10 years. But it's coming back. What about when we fought the war in Korea? Well, we got South Korea, and they're building pretty nice cars and doing a lot of other stuff. Then there's North Korea, which is evil. What about Iran? What about Red China? You know, a lot of people say, well, China, you know, they're kind of, you know, they're like us. They have sort of some kind of something kind of capitalism. No, they don't. They don't have a free market. Their capitalism is controlled by the government, which is really a hidden form of socialism. They're just smart. They're good at marketing themselves. Who runs them? A few hundred people in Beijing, for the most part, called the leaders of the communist regime. Well, what about Hong Kong? It's free, isn't it? No. It's just made to look free while they gain more and more control and power over the people there. No. Don't be fooled. And that's like a large proportion of the population. Not all the people who live in China believe in the Chinese system. No. I would say it's less than half. Remember, it's only a quarter of the world. And we've got some pretty big numbers when we talk about Russia, China, North Korea, Iran. How about Venezuela, Cuba, and a few other, Nicaragua, a few other countries right in our own backyard. How many real democracies are there where there's actual freedom? In Saudi Arabia, it's a democracy. As a matter of fact, you think people who believe in extreme types of Islam follow the democracy? What are they believing? I mean, so when you start looking at the whole world and you start adding up the numbers, we got some pretty big numbers. I'm not saying it's 1 out of 4 that are evil, but it's 1 out of 4 that are being affected by evil. And in 1 or 2 generations, they can become evil. That's how fast it can move, particularly if it reaches the 5th mental subworld. It'll take about just 2 generations. That's 40 years, folks. How scary is that? Well, about as scary as you get, because that means that if you reach that in 40 years, another 40 years, and I don't think we'll be here anymore. Or less, it could be another 10 years. It could be anything that God chooses in his plan. Now, God is intervened by beings called monads and members of the next kingdom. But don't fool yourself. There isn't a lot of help to be had from those sources if you turn your back What if you're an atheist, but you believe in humanity, humanistic ideas? You believe in treating people fairly and lovingly, etc. How are you going to turn it? Well, you have to ask yourself this. If you don't understand the principles of God's plan or the tests of life, it's very easy for someone to convince you of the opposite, and you not even know that that's what they're doing. That's what many dictators do, by the way, in the beginning of their careers. It's a bummer. It's something to concern ourselves with. Now, I don't want to make this into a doom and gloom show, but it is something to be very concerned about. Because our part of the plan on this planet is in great test. How do we succeed when the forces of darkness are moving in around us? Well, sacrifice is going to be called for. Some people are going to need to probably sacrifice some of their principles. Let me explain this. Right now, it's my belief that the present administration is very dark. Some of it is just objectively evil. Talking about the administration controlling the national government and some other parts of government as well. Then what is it that we're going to do about that? Well, you need to find that in your principles you support those things that carry with them a means of God's plan and test of life, which is right now we're in it, for it to succeed regardless of your own personal belief structure, which may include certain notions that are not very accurate. Some people say, well, I won't vote for anybody who believes in this, that, or the other thing. Anyone who says that they're not in favor of right to life from the second of conception. Well, okay, then you got a problem. I won't vote for anybody that has these five other things that are so important to me. What happens eventually is that you splinter the issue. The issue is God's plan in a test of life, coming right now, that is in the face of evil. And it's all around us. It's in this country. It's not just around this country. And if we don't face it now, we will more likely lose. And we'll lose because of our own obstinance that has to do with the fifth mental subworld. We will be the cause for evil taking over the fifth mental subworld through our own egotism about it. Now, what is the fifth mental subworld like? What are the issues? Fifth mental subworld deals with issues of justice, issues of law, issues of fairness. It deals with science, but the science of truth and openness to new and sometimes contrary ideas about what you believe to be true. It deals with the self-reflection of one's ability to admit error and mistake. What is evil trying to do? It's trying to make us more arrogant, more egotistical, more certain that we're right. Because that's its ticket into the fifth subworld. It loves that. What else is evil trying to do? They're trying to convince us that certain things are more important than anything else. Whatever that is in your belief structure. What's more important? Having an evil government? Or having a government that allows various beliefs that you have to exist? At least down to the selection of who's going to be leading this country in the future. So here is part of the process we're in right now. We are fighting out a battle in the fifth sub-world. It's happening in the mental world first. It will become a physical battle, and that could be destructive to all of us. But right now, it's a mental battle. And how do we win that mental battle? Through humility, through open-mindedness, through sacrificing some of our sacred cows about a specific belief structure, including I'm this kind of Republican or that kind of independent, maybe even this kind of Democrat. But it's a certain kind of belief structure of openness and willingness to allow others to possibly make choices that are counter to ours, but leads us into light. You don't give up the darkness, give in to darkness, as I should say, just because you have a certain amount of values. We see this occurring right now, and I want you to consider this. The majority of people in the Republican wing of the politics, and some independents, want to have someone who can beat our President Obama. More importantly than anything else. I think this is good as the first criteria that we use in determining who we choose to be president. Why? Because if that's the criteria, and if you think that the president as he exists today is dark, even evil, then the process is to overcome that among anything else. Now you might say, well, I violently disagree with you that President Obama is evil or even dark. He's just trying to do the best he can. That's fine. If you want to believe that, that's okay. But for those who think otherwise, the first criteria should be, how do we change this problem? Not what issues underlying it are important to us at this point. And so that's a probably very critical issue. Does that mean that everybody's going to get the person to run that they think is the best person to be president? Probably not. We'll be lucky to remove the present administration. If the present administration remains in place, I'm afraid it may lead to the destruction of God's plan from Earth. Now, that sounds pretty radical. And I never thought of myself as being highly political. And in many ways, I'm not being political. I'm just seeing what I think to be a great darkness. And I compare one thing being said one month, the next month, the next month, the next month, and I hear one line after another, after another, after another, and I see actions not meaning what words were said. And I see a lot of deception and propaganda and the use of media in very bad ways. Now, some of this certainly happens in all parts of politics, but not on a consistent level and not to the level that is presently taking place. Also, the need and the use and the little taking of power. It's very frightening. Remember, the dark side seeks power and control. The side of light seeks a balance between spirit and the interchange or exchange of energies, and seeks light. If you can't find the light in God's plan, you won't be able to see the darkness that is surrounding us more and more. Many people have trouble seeing the darkness, but most importantly, you need to understand what the light is about. The light is not about all people being the same. God's plan is to test life for individuality at the human level when humans are here, and we are. And that is what it's about. That means things like free markets are good. Controlled or no markets are bad. Communism is evil. Socialism, most of the time, leads to darkness and eventually despotism, except in very small groups or even very, very small countries. So, really, if we're going to be open-minded, we need to first see light. And if you don't believe in God and you're an atheist, it's going to be even more difficult for you to find an evil around you until it's too late. For those out there who are in that camp and yet who are still listening to this show, there's probably a good deal of hope. But most people in that camp are not going to ever listen to this show, because they usually are too arrogant, at least egotistical. Remember, humility is the answer. You need to be humble. Open-mindedness. Look for the truth yourself. Don't, of course, believe anything I say because I say it. Check it out. But check it out with an open mind. That's the answer. Okay, so let's go a little further ahead. We've got just a few minutes here. Let's leave us on the most positive note we can. God's plan for the test of life is going to be, hopefully, a success story here on Earth by the leading country or countries, or U.S. is one of them, finding that those who seek power and control and abuse their powers, those who try to intimidate and control the system, and those who use propaganda, those who lie to us on a very continuous basis, are removed from power as quickly and as soon as possible. We need to ensure that we stick with the integrity of what this country was originally about. Limited government, in which the fear of government was the first fear of all. And the fear of government controlling and taking over our lives way before where we are today, was the hallmark of the people of the creation of our country. We need to reinstitute that as our bottom line. Do we have to become libertarians to do that? No. We just need to be able to see the light. If you are a libertarian, you may see some of the light, but you may also hold on to certain very hardened belief structures that may make it hard for you to vote for anyone other than just a libertarian. And that may mean the darkness will just take over because you're too close-minded to see that that position won't be inclusive enough for the majority of people. Why is it? Why is it that a libertarian who believes in absolute freedom of this and that doesn't have the right track? Because in God's plan, the test of life is not to just live only free, but to live free and also to live in a loving fashion that also supports healthy interactions. That doesn't necessarily include all of the structure and belief of libertarianism. Libertarians believe that it's cool if people want to just shoot up this drug or that drug and kill themselves and then go out and commit crimes or do whatever else. Because until they actually break the law, they should be allowed to do so. The problem with that system is that you're always behind the eight ball. By the time people are out breaking the law, so many people are doing it that you have lawlessness. So you have to find some buffer, some in-between point, where people are not absolutely free. They give up some rights so that there is civility love, consciousness, and the development of right interactions between people. So pure libertarianism is not necessarily God's plan. It needs to be the balance of the other two parts of God. The first part of God's plan is freedom. The second two have to be balanced within it. If you go to one side too much, you end up with too little and destruction. What about those who are the staunch liberals who believe that there should be redistribution of wealth in a socialistic fashion? Or worse, that the government should control our lives, including all elements of economy, but beyond that, all other elements. And they're more communist. What is there about that that is so special to them? Well, they believe that God is a God of total equality between all. But that certainly is not true in evolution, which they usually believe in, by the way, which is strange. And it's not true in spirit either, because that would mean that there are no more individuals. You have collectivism, and that would be a step backward from humanity. That would be back somewhere in the animal kingdom, maybe even all the way back to some plants. So it is a problem in misunderstanding God, and maybe in denying God, that folks of that bent get to. And that's their problem. What about people who are somewhere independent in the middle? Well, they've got their own foibles. They want to be independent of making a choice of seeing God. Some of them, therefore, don't even believe in God. But they have a belief that they are choosing the right thing because they're not choosing a political thing, a policy issue. They don't base their judgment on policy. They base it upon everybody getting along and there being equality in that sense. They may also believe in redistribution as well. So you've got all of these factions trying to work in a way in which there is more light in the world. And my suggestion is to give up some of the politics of the situation and instead just deal with it from light. If you don't believe in God, then believe in some universal kind of goodness from someplace and try to see the light as much as possible, because that's the only way you'll ever be able to deal with the darkness. That's my suggestion. And the darkness is real, and it's definitely coming. So hopefully some of this will make some sense. Hopefully God's plan for testing us makes some sense. And the biggest tests are coming soon. Okay, until next week, this has been Niles McFlower for Why Life Is.